Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
I'm Greg Barron, and you're listening to Storyworthy with the side of your face.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from the headquarters of The Nervous Breakdown magazine.
Wow.
It's a literary magazine.
Really, from what city?
Well, it exists in cyberspace.
Mm.
So we're floating now in cyberspace, sort of.
We haven't been here before.
I know. It's their sort of digital. We've been digitalized. It's like Tron, except it's entertaining.
Is there really a magazine called Nervous Breakdown?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess so.
NervousBreakdown.com.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's legitimate, obviously.
Exactly. Well, obviously. And we're sitting here, we're floating in amongst the protons and the cretons and the...
And we're talking about Nervous Breakdowns tonight because of our guest, Greg Barrett, is here.
Yes. He causes Nervous Breakdowns
Greg
wherever
Barrett.
He goes. People are just, oh my God, I can't believe who it is. And they fall to the ground and they...
He's a comedian. He's an author. And he's just done so many things over such a pretty long period of time.
Yes.
And he's kind of worn many hats.
Something that many comedians don't have.
That you could call it a career. And apparently he's had a nervous breakdown. So this is exciting to talk about. I mean, a nervous breakdown is very, very personal.
Exactly. And that's the kind of story we like. We like a story that causes the teller to be questioning whether they should be telling it. Why am I talking to these two morons here in cyberspace? Why am I revealing this truth about myself?
So it's a mental disorder, right? Or it can lead up to, a nervous breakdown.
Nervous breakdowns, I believe, are not related to mental illness per se. They are just an over,
No, but it's the level of your anxiety, and it can lead up to, and you can sometimes know when that's going to happen. You can kind of predict
it. Yeah, I used to get anxiety attacks all the time.
But now you're medicated.
I'm medicated, and I'm also just, I don't want to say I'm smarter because I have learned nothing over the years, but much like anything with experience comes wisdom. Mm-hmm. So the more anxiety attacks you have, the more anxiety where you're like, oh my God, I'm going to die right now, even though I know I'm perfectly safe inside this room. Eventually, you realize that you're bullshitting yourself, and you're not going to die right now.
Mm-hmm. No, but it's just very, very real, and
then
it's
very
true.
Extremely, right. Yeah. When you have it, I was describing anxiety attacks as the exact fear, as if someone tied you to a train track, and there's a train coming to you.
Right.
And that's the way you feel, except that none of that's happening. And there's nobody threatening you and nothing's happening.
Yeah,
and
but
as
that's,
I've stated
that's
before,
a horrible in
my
feeling.
Deep ways, yeah, it's like the subconscious mind and cannot tell the difference between reality and fantasy.
Well, I remember, because I've been on Prozac, I've kind of been on and off it over the years, but I remember when I first went on it and you would tell me, you think it's going to change your personality, but it doesn't at all. It just takes away the anxiety that you're feeling, which you can't see the anxiety. It's sort of not tangible because it's within you.
Yeah.
So what did we do before prescription medications?
Drink.
It was alcohol.
It was alcohol.
Or anything
still is
else.
For many, many people. Alcohol still is just
self-medicating.
People who drink a lot are just self-medicating. People who smoke a lot are generally just
self-medicating. So the fact that I smoke a lot of weed could do with why I don't need Prozac as much? You think there's a correlation
but
there?
But you're also conscious of the fact that the amount you smoke is medicating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you're
saying. As opposed to...
Well, it's medicinal marijuana, isn't it?
A bottle of whiskey every day and go, no, I'm just Irish. It's like, no, you have deep-seated problems.
But there's also the whole idea of, like, in terms of, you have a cup of coffee to wake up. You
there
have
are people
a cup of chamomile
things.
Tea to go down. I mean, so we're all day long.
There are people who are addicted to work. I cannot understand this addiction at all. But there are people who are like, I got to work every day, every minute of every day, man. It's like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
But a nervous breakdown is something where it's different in terms of there's a change, right? Something happens where there's something that something completely changes. There's a shift.
I'm sure that there are many psychologists probably have specific categories, but I would say nervous breakdowns are just a breaking point where it's like something has been going on, something's built up to a point where suddenly it's changed, and now it's like your body's like, we're going to break you down literally to the point where you're going to have to change something.
Yeah, so your body decides to make a physical decision.
Like, we're out.
We're not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Do you think if you are medicated that you could have a nervous breakdown? Because that seems like the scariest
thing.
Well,
if you were improperly medicated, I'm sure you
could. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
It's like, I mean, if you're perfectly medicated, then no, obviously not.
So if you think you have it together, but and then if you don't have it together, you weren't
perfect. There are people who are good on Prozac like me, and there are people who don't take Prozac well.
I thought you changed. I thought you on Prozac?
I'm a Prozac guy. Millions of years ago, somebody gave me something. I think it was Albutrin or something, but this was early.
It was
something with an A, Al something. I mean, this is
Al Gore.
You know, this is Lincoln was president when this and
it was aspirin.
It was aspirin, exactly. And I didn't like that. But that stuff has all grown sophisticated at this point. And then my brother, who we've discussed before, who is an actual schizophrenic, it's like the sophistication of his medication over the past 20 years compared to what he had is light years ahead.
It's a cocktail of drugs, but
yeah,
they've streamlined
it's
perhaps.
Light years ahead of being able to be very specific as to what chemicals in the brain they're affecting, as opposed to just like, listen, you need to calm the fuck down.
But your brother was mentally ill as a schizophrenic. I mean, he still is.
Yes, he is. But the medications that help him control that are completely different now than he'd take medication and he'd just be a fucking zombie.
But that's not anxiety. That's not he never had a nervous breakdown. He was it's a different thing, right?
Yeah, I guess there's nothing to break down from if you're spending the whole time doing that.
I see. Well, anyway, so a nervous breakdown. I'm really anxious to hear the story because Greg has had this career of up and down and all around, and now he's in a band. Have you heard his band, The Reigning Monarchs?
If I say no, is he going to be upset?
I don't know if I don't think he'll be upset, but
okay, you know what?
It's so good. It's just this music you just want to have on in the background. I'm going to find some of that.
I will say to Greg, not that he's here in the room right now, that I haven't listened to any song past 1985.
Yeah.
So
Hannah stopped at Journey. Or was
I did not stop at Journey.
It was REO Speedwagon. No, just say it.
Oh, yeah, I do like REO Speedwagon. Damn it.
Before we bring our storyteller on, you guys, I did want to mention that if you'd like to support the Storyworthy podcast, there's so many things you can do. That's what we like to do, folks. We like to give you a choice.
Right. You can do simple things like just tell your friends. For God's sake, would it hurt you?
The word of mouth is a really big deal, Hannes.
Take the Facebook page, and share it and say, hey, here's a podcast I really like. You guys should check it out.
There you go.
Just do that.
Or, of course, you can follow us.
You lazy fucking bastard.
Follow us on Twitter at Storyworthy. Head on over to Storyworthy Media or StoryworthyPodcast.com. You can purchase my new book. I have a book.
You can purchase
Christine's
book.
It is actually officially
my Storyworthy life.
It's officially out, isn't it? Yes.
It is. And it is. You can have it as an ebook if you want to. Yeah. Damn kids. Or you can buy an actual physical book.
And I did the audio version as well. So there's all sorts of ways to get Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life. And, of course, you can follow us on Facebook. But you don't have to. That gets boring. Do you think that gets boring, the Facebook?
No. It's the beauty part. I'll say this about Facebook. You follow us. That's it. You don't have to do anything else.
Oh, I see. Like, you don't have to keep up or actually read
our page. Yeah, it's like you follow us. Every time there's an episode, it'll show up on your page,
check.
And you'll be fine.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. All right, you guys. Listen, wherever you are, hang tight, because our storyteller, Greg Behrendt, is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have writer-comedian Carol Ann Leaf.
And I'm going to tell you how being a sports fan can win you a lot of pizza.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hi, you know those promos where they tell you who they are and who you're listening to? Well, get ready to hear another one. Hi, everybody. This is Todd Glass, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Into Netflix, into an episode of Frasier, and we are now at the Cafe Nervosa, which is their favorite place to hang out. if you recall watching Frasier.
That show Frasier was so gosh darn smart, right?
It was a great show.
Yeah.
Great show.
I mean, amazing.
I just saw one the other day. It was one of my favorite ones. They're arguing with the dad about whether he gets to watch his game show or they get to watch the show on PBS. And it turns out they're both talking about Antiques Roadshow. And then they develop a drinking game where every time they say texture, they have to take a drink. Or, you know, the whole episode is them getting drunk watching Antiques Roadshow.
Very smart.
That's brilliant.
I have a feeling our guest also probably likes Frasier, I would think. Do you like Frasier?
I would assume.
I would think so. Yeah.
Some quality entertainment.
All right, you guys. He's here right now. Greg Barron, as I said, he's a comedian and an author and a producer. You know, he wrote the New York Times bestseller list. He's just not that into you.
Yeah. The best-selling
book from 2004.
Best-selling book from the list. Yes.
Yeah.
He's just not – I got confused.
When that got hot, that got so hot.
Like
it was so
hot.
On fire.
It was
really amazing. But I don't know if the Facebook was as big then. I don't think Facebook was even around then.
That would be more of a MySpace time, I believe.
It was later adapted into a film made by the same name. Greg also used to have –
I saw that movie.
He also hosted two television shows. I know, right?
There fucking we go. Wrote and the beginning of the nervous breakdown starts.
He also hosted two shows, The Greg Barron Show and also Greg Barron's Wake Up Call. And he's also been on The Tonight Show and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And he's been on Oprah a couple of times. And I'm dying
and
to know.
And he was on her show. Oh!
What she's like.
He was on her.
Oh, for goodness sake. Yeah. You can find him over at gregbarrant.com and also on Twitter at Gregory Barrant. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Greg Barrant. Yay!
All right, so I've done this anecdotally on stage, and I've told it to friends, but I've never just laid it out as a story. So I have to give it some context. As you've already said, in 2004, I was the lucky author of the book He's Just Not That Into, which in 2003 was a conversation had among friends. I was a consultant on the show Sex and the City, where I worked for many years as a consultant. And my job on there was as the only straight male. My job was to say that guy shouldn't have a purse. And I worked there for the entire run. And in the final season, there was a girl on the staff who was seeing a guy that didn't want to have sex with her. And on a lunch break, I was having a cookie in the hallway. I was not engaged with anybody. I was simply enjoying a white chocolate chip and craisin oatmeal cookie, and she said, could I have a minute with you? You're the only guy here. I've been seeing this guy, and we went out last night, and I invited him up to have sex, and he declined. Do you think that's bad? And after staring at her for about a minute, I said, for real? And she said, yes. And I said, yeah, it's bad. And then she got kind of defensive with me. And she goes, well, you had to work, Greg. And I said, I don't care if you had to fly the space shuttle. You come up. You get that offer. You're a dude. I don't know what we're doing then. I'm not sure what the relationship is. I mean, if it's a sexual thing, if it's a relationship, I'm coming up. So we sort of debated a little bit. I'm not sure why we were debating. And then I didn't want to have been in the fucking conversation in the first place. And then Liz Tuchillo, who was another writer on the staff who I like very much, came over and she got involved in the conversation. And at some point I go, look, fuck, he's just not that into you. And I don't remember saying the words at all. It was not a conversation that it didn't feel like a conversation of any import. So I went back into the writer's room, but then everyone wanted to continue talking about it, and we talked about it, and suddenly it became this thing, and then suddenly everyone was asking me questions. Did you what if a guy what if a guy's got a girlfriend? And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? And there were all these questions, and I thought we were like, it was silly, and anyway, it became this sort of buzzy thing that we all talked about. We all had a lot of laughs, and I realized that people were being sincere, and that I wasn't, that these were genuine questions from women who were smart, and women who were, these were girls that wrote television and had money and were pretty. And I was like, guys, I'm not sure why you're selling yourself so short, but blah, 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 blah. Yes. Why are you wasting your time with these lesser beings when you shouldn't be? So it made it into an episode. It became a buzzy thing. And then the show was over. And Liz came to me and said, I think there's a book in this. And I said, a pamphlet maybe that you hand out at a bar. Ha, ha, ha. And we wrote a book. And in the second week of publication, we went on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Yeah. Now, up until that point, I had put 15 years in, hard years into being a comedian. That's what I was. That's what I am. I'm a stand-up comic. And I had done it inch by inch without the internet, without, you know, without TV credits, really. Like, I had one Comedy Central special up to that point. I'd had a couple of TV appearances, but I'd really done it the old-fashioned way. Not to complain. That's just what there was at the time. Yeah. It's how I saw myself. And I had invested no time in a career as a relationship counselor. I'd gotten a degree in theater,
yeah,
which is the same thing as failing out of college. So I went on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and because I'm a pretty good entertainer, we had a great episode. It was me being silly and answering questions to these girls who had been left at the altar and blah, blah, blah. And Oprah was fun. And Oprah is a television pro.
Yeah.
By the way, when you go on her show, you realize she's just an entertainer herself. She's an entertainer. Mm-hmm. So when you're on a TV show with an entertainer and you're an entertainer, we sparked and we had a blast together. And she was setting them up and I was knocking them back. And that's all it was. It was television. It was nothing more than that. And then it aired the next week, and I was consulting on another TV show at that point, a one season mid-season replacement called Committed. And I'm there in the writer's room, and we watched the show, and we all had a laugh, and my buddy goes, go see where it is on Amazon. And we checked in the morning, and it was at like at 800, which wasn't even a bad spot at that point.
Yeah.
And then by midnight that night, it was at number one, and it stayed at number one from that day in September to Christmas, back and forth with Jon Stewart's America. But in a 24-hour period, I'd gone from a not really well-known but a comedian to a globally known relationship expert. So the complexion of my life changed, and there was no internet. I was going to jump in when you guys made the point, but there was no internet. So you were just either one thing or you weren't. So I became a relationship expert, for lack of a better. And I remember coming out of Oprah feeling like, oh, what have I just done to my comedy career? Like, I was aware that something had happened that day. So cut to, the book does very well, and I feel like I won a prize. I certainly have gratitude. I'm the recipient of something that most people will never, you know what I mean? Like, even great comics will never receive the gifts that I got that day. Yeah. But I'm also only allowed to do certain things now. I'm not being seen anymore as a guy in development for TV shows. And I'm doing comedy shows, but only women are coming out. And I'm being booked as the he's just not that into you guy. And I'm not being seen as an actor, and I'm not being seen as anything but a relationship guy. So the only thing that I'm being offered is a daytime talk show, and that's it. And I push it away for a year and a half. But Sony keeps coming, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So whatever. Again, gratitude. Money's being thrown at me. We write a second book. It goes right into the New York Times bestseller list. But no one knows what it's called because it still doesn't do as big as the first book, right? Yeah. We sell the rights to the first book to make a movie. Liz and I make a lot of money, blah, 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 blah. I buy a home. I do the thing. It all goes, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I get the talk show. I get a reality series. It all runs its course. But nothing is as big as my appearance on Oprah. Nothing matches that moment. The talk show goes away. The reality show doesn't even air. And within a period of about 4 years, it just runs its course and it's over. At the same time, the internet sort of shows up. And in that period, I was explaining to someone the other day, suddenly you're able to see other people's careers. For the first time in your life, you can see what your buddies are doing. Suddenly you can look and see what they're doing on Facebook. Suddenly you're aware of what other things are happening. So now And also, in some weird fell swoop, we have a third book. It gets dropped. I lose my agent. I lose my manager. I lose my lawyer. Just suddenly, everything sort of fell apart. And that weird thing where the phone stops ringing, and in that classic Hollywood way, it just happens. It's not anyone's fault. Now, trust me. Again, I am not acting like I'm boo-hoo me. I'm just telling you the facts, man. And your brain just doesn't know how to deal. Now, I also find out at this point I'm prone to depression and anxiety, and probably have been my whole life. But it's accelerating at a rate that I don't understand. And all I have left is my stand-up. So I go, all right, I'm going to go on the road. I can still do that. I'm still selling out, and I'm still got that thing. fortunately, the movie's coming out in 2009. So I'm selling out rooms, but they're all women. They don't care about my stand-up, but I've got enough. So I ball together enough comedy about the book that I can do my stand-up and put it together. But they come out. They don't buy my CD. They won't buy my DVD. Comedy Central doesn't want to put me on. They don't want to make a special. Like, it's all I have left is to go out and do these rooms where I go. I sell it out for the weekend, but then the next time I'm there, nobody comes back. So then the club stops booking me. So I'm sort of squeezing what's left out of my stand-up career, which is all I have left. So I'm starting to kind of go crazy. But then the movie comes out. So then the push comes back to do press. So now it's 5 years later, and I'm talking about the book again, but it's all over. So I'm really resentful, and I'm going crazy. I'm actually starting to go crazy. I'm feeling like I'm going crazy. And I'm in an airport, and I call my manager, and I go, dude, I can't do that. I can't talk about myself anymore, because I'm also talking about myself a lot, which is the beginning of what people call narcissism, which I don't believe is an actual thing. What I think narcissism is when you have anxiety and depression, your brain closes in on itself, and all you can do is think about yourself. So narcissism becomes this inward-looking battle of you sort of defending yourself against your own brain. So you can't see outwardly. You can't see your wife or your children or your friends. And all you can do is sort of focus inward. And then, unfortunately, the advent of the internet makes it so that all you can do is see what Marc Maron is doing, or who's anybody.
Yeah.
Anybody. It doesn't even matter. Why is Jen Kirkman? Like, you suddenly are obsessing on what anybody's doing. Who's Christine Black? Why is she friends with Patton? Like, it doesn't matter what anyone's doing. Yeah. It's not you, and you're not happening. And your priorities and your everything gets stuck in this box. And I started to go absolutely nuts. So cut to. And this is the beginning of knowing that I'm really going crazy. And I'm starting to resent my own fans, because when they come to the shows, they don't pay attention to the show. All they want is their book signed. And they're women. By the way, they're lovely women,
yeah,
who like the book. And why wouldn't they come to the show? And why wouldn't they come because of the book? That's all they know me from. Yeah. It's not their fault either. They bought a book. It changed their lives for whatever reason. They're grateful, and they want to see me. And I'm mad because they don't want to hear the bit about me fingering my dog. I'm mad because they don't want to hear the bit about me loving Aerosmith. Like, I am this bit. I have turned into the bitterest, shittiest, self-centered fuck in a cardigan. So, and I'm trying too. Like, I can't figure out how to make my peace with it. And some nights the shows are good and sometimes they're not. And I'm trying to be true to what I do too. Like, I just don't know how to make peace with it. And sometimes the women are fucked, and it's a lot of bachelorette parties. And that's when it really gets tough. Because sometimes they're just fucking rude. So it's a Thursday night. It's New York City. It's Caroline's. And it is on the 20th anniversary of my having started stand-up to the day. It's a Thursday. The club's probably two-thirds full. The movie is, I think it's just come out. I go in. There's a bachelorette party right up against the stage. They've got, like, cock hats on or something. It's horrible. Most of the bachelorette party is okay, but there's a girl right up against the stage, and she won't shut the fuck up, and she's got her phone out, and she's talking, and she won't stop, and it's going terrible. Sometimes when there's one person in the club that won't stop talking, and then management's doing nothing for some reason, as they do sometimes, nobody can have a good time, because half the people around that table are looking at her, and they won't laugh, so then the whole room is just thrown off, and there's not a big enough crowd for it to, like, just – I can't change the room. So I'm struggling, and I haven't struggled like this ever. And it's 20 years in the game, and I've got flop sweats, and I can't get her to shut up, and I can't get the room – I can't get a consensus going. Finally, I try and deal with it, and I walk over to her, and I go, look, lady, are you a fan of my books? And she said, yes, I am. And I go, have you read my new one called Would You Shut Your Fucking Mouth So the Rest of Us Could Enjoy the Show? It just – no laughs. It gets worse. So – I finally go to the other side of the room, and I start doing this bit that it's like sometimes you just throw down a gamble and go, well, this is one of my favorite bits. It's big. It's loud. If I don't get him with this, I'm not going to get him at all. I do the bit. It just goes – it just nothing. It ends with me shouting. The punchline is like, go to Hot Topics and get a bracelet. It's about Chris Angel. It's about how much I love magic and I hate magicians. And it's about how he fucking does this horrible trick in a mall, but it's a cool trick. How people never act like magical. You know how people always, because when people do magic, they're always like, ta-da. I go, that's not how you would act. I go, if you could really make a bird, you'd be fucking terrified.
Yeah.
You'd be like, you know, every time you'd made a bird, you go, fuck, I can make birds. Like, you would be terrified of your own trick. If you could actually make birds, it would scare the shit out of you. You'd be asking people, am I a god? What's wrong with me? You wouldn't be like, oh, fuck, and then go down to Hot Topics and get a bracelet. So that's how it ends. It's a good fucking bit. I'm very proud of it. So I yell, bracelet, 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 and it fucking bombs. And I'm standing there just losing. And she goes, boo. And I turn around. And it's just silent. You can hear people's blood running through their veins. Everything that's wrong. And I just walk over. I don't flip out. I just walk over and quietly get into her face and go, fuck you. I go, you are the worst person I've ever met. I go, now I've been doing this for 20 years, so I'll bounce back. But everybody in this place should have burned their money in the fucking parking lot because you ruined this night for everyone. Do you understand that? You're a bad fucking person. And you have a black heart and a black soul, and I fucking hate you. Hang on. It gets worse. And then she starts crying, bursts into tears. And I have no plan, by the way. Like, I don't know what happens after this. Like, once I've unloaded, I'm just staring at her like, oh, fuck. I got nothing. I'm just, like, looking at her. And then she starts bawling. And she reaches into her handbag and she pulls out a copy of He's Just Not That Into You. And she holds it up and she's like, you were supposed to talk about this. This is why we came out to see you, which I'm obviously aware of. You've ruined our night. You've ruined our evening, which is all fair. But then she goes to this whole other place. My boyfriend left me. I'm alone. Nobody wants me. Now, all of that's fair enough. But she has, and she was actually pretty. She was kind of cute. But she had my boyfriend. She had the ugliest voice. My boyfriend left me. And she was snorting. It was unreal. And the people behind her are laughing so hard now. They're weeping. My boyfriend left me. Like that. And the whole place is fucking just heaving, trying to not laugh. So they're like, people are now just weeping. And she's, you're a bad person and I'm alone. And then a dude stands up. And this is why I love New York. A dude stands up in the back corner and goes, well, no wonder nobody will fuck you. And then I give him the fucking cut it sign. But at the same time, I want to hug him. You know, I'm like, dude, no. And then another guy stands up. This is all true. I swear to God. Another guy stands up and goes, hey, I'll fuck her. And the place just bursts into laughter. Just fucking everyone's just like fucking bursts into laughter. So then I just go, thank you. Good night. And I fucking throw the mic down. And I left and I called my manager. And I'm like, I quit. I've quit. I quit. You got to cancel. I canceled like, I don't know, like 15 gigs. I had a lot of money. Like, I just can't. I can't. I don't know what's going on with me. I just ruined this woman's life. She's probably going to have to be in therapy for years. I have to be in therapy for years. Like, I don't know what just happened because I'm not a mean person. That's the other thing. Like, this is like, I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy. And I got to quit. Now, this has a nice little bow on it. So I go home. It was a weird year. My wife had given me a purse for Christmas. The Merce or whatever it was. It was a man. Yeah, it was a bummer. I wore it one day. I saw myself in a bank window. I was like, God, that woman's got a bad haircut. So I got into therapy and whatever, this other stuff. But like 6 months later, I was home with my daughters. And I was coming down the hallway. There was a My Little Pony hair clip on the floor. And I put the My Little Pony hair clip in my hair. And I run into a bazaar and I see them and they laugh. I fucking kill. And It made me feel good. I was like, you know, my gut instinct is to make people laugh. It's what I do. And if that's not what people want, that's fine. But that's what I do. And that's what I have to do. I can't just stop. And I can't worry about what people think. I can't be that guy. I just have to do that. And I just have to let it go. And if that's not what people want, that's not what they want. But that's what I have to do. And I'll just have to deal with it. And I should be fucking grateful. You know what I mean? I have money and I have a life and I have children and whatever. So I feel good about that. Not that the joke was hilarious, but I have My Little Pony hair clip and my mohawk. I had a mohawk at the time. And I feel good. And I go to the store. And I forget that I have a My Little Pony hair clip in. And I'm walking around Trader Joe's. And people are fucking smiling at me. And waving and winking and, like, looking at me. And I swear to God, I don't realize that I have a My Little Pony hair clip in my hair. And I literally thought to myself, I'm fucking back. My mojo is back. Like, the universe is digging me. And I run into a friend of mine, Jason Nash. Do you guys know Jason? And he's with his wife, and they've had a baby. And I'm so excited to see them. I'm like, hey, what's going on? And they both seem very surprised to see me. And I'm like, hey, man, good to see you, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, right on, dude. Well, congratulations on your baby. I walk out. It's fucking huge, by the way. It's a big flower with a purple center and ribbons. There's ribbons. There are ribbons on it that go over my ear that I can't see. I'm checking out. The fucking checkout lady's looking at me, smiling like I'm a... Like, she's kind of making eyes at me. And I'm like, I'm married, lady. I fucking check out. I go to my car. I go to back out. I look at myself. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. It's huge. I go home. I call Jason. I'm like, fucking dude, I had a My Little Pony hair clip in at the store. And he's like, fuck, dude, you're the guy with the purse. I just figured it was your thing.
Wow, that's a terrific story. Wait a second. I want to go back to that night at Caroline's.
Yeah.
Because it seems like you really made a lot happen in that room.
Mm-hmm.
So she's crying, but other people are laughing. Your joke bombs. I mean, I just feel like the energy that must have been so magnified that you as a professional comedian could see that, even if it wasn't the magnification you were aiming for, or the effect that you were aiming for, it's still, you created something. So it just surprises me that you would have dropped the mic and you were done. I mean...
Oh, no, that didn't surprise me. I thought that he was absolutely right. That guy, and it, you know what? That guy said, oh, fucker, and huge laugh. You're going to get credit for the laugh.
Well, it was that thing of like...
How much
it was like
time
the guy
done?
Made the joke, this guy tagged it. I'm like, that's how it goes. It's like solid joke, big
but
tag,
how much time
boom.
Had you done?
Yeah.
At that point, I think the show had gotten to about 40 minutes, and I
Which
was like, we were done, because I was burning through material.
What was it supposed to be?
You know, 50.
Yeah, oh, okay, so not that much shorter.
No, and I'm going to say, I mean, okay, so technically by the rules, what you said to her was out of line. But by the rules, she was already way out of line.
She
and
was
I think
way
the
out
audience,
of line
in a way, despite the fact that, like, the audience not going for your bit about Criss Angel, which just you telling us a tiny bit here is obviously
so
fucking hilarious. It's sometimes I think the audience they were so fucked by her at that point that they couldn't even concentrate to listen to your actual bit.
I think
so. And so they were so once you I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm,
yeah.
But once you said that to her, which they're like, "Doom," and then it became about her because she wanted it to be about her. Then they were able to laugh at her, and then they became an audience. Does that make sense?
Yes. I think there is something sometimes organically happening where sometimes you see somebody and you go, what's wrong? Why isn't this working?
Yeah.
Like, you can even listen to someone and go, I know these words are funny.
Yeah.
Why am I not laughing? What's wrong? There's something organically wrong. And especially most audiences are first-timers. No matter where you go,
unless you're at
a Bill Burr concert or someplace
that's interesting.
Where it's
not
a cultural phenomenon, right? Or say here at Springsteen, like, you know that there's a people here for a ritual. Most people at most concerts are first or second timers, mm-hmm. and they are just having a night, and they're there.
They want you to succeed.
They want you to succeed.
They want everybody to be entertained.
But they're nervous already, and then something's off, and why can't he control her? And why isn't the club doing something? And then now she's got control of the room. And when you lose it, by the way, when you yell at somebody, you've lost. I lost. As soon as I start yelling at her, you know, like, you don't have to be in show business to know I've played my final hand. I played a pair of twos. She's won the game because she got
In other words, you needed to look at her just with a slight smile and say, like, you know, oh, it's you again. I, you know, you perhaps don't care for this material. Perhaps you would like me to validate you
exactly.
for the
I could have
incredible
done something nice.
Woman
right,
you are.
Right.
And
right.
I love how she's like, holds up the book. You were supposed to talk about this. Now, what were you literally... I mean, she's probably not the first person to say that, except it made no sense. Were you supposed to stand there and read out of the book?
Well, it depends on how he was being pitched, too. I mean, Hannes, if that's what the promoter was saying,
well,
you know, it's the
a lot of the promotion does say he's just not that into it.
So they think it's going to be a relationship type show.
Exactly. And I would say to David, you can't let them say that. If you want to say New York Times bestselling author, that could mean anything. But at the same time, the club's like, well, then how are we going to get people in here?
See,
so
the thing is...
there's the duality of it, like, and that is how people know me.
And women do really like you because you're attractive. So there's this No, I'm not kidding. I mean, you could pull off a... That's, you know, also as being the talk show host. I mean, you could see you as, like, this guy that a woman would like to get approval from.
Right.
So these women come to the show wanting to be, you know, what's the word? Assuaged. Or, you know, they
want... I sat down with some comedy friends of mine. Right. I sat down with some buddies. The other night, you know, a couple years ago, I started a podcast
and I
did it up until this summer and it really helped bring a comedy fan base back. But one of the things one of my buddies said was, it's so weird. Your comedy fans seem to really not enjoy your comedy. And I was like, that is really one of the problems I've had for a long time is like, they don't really know me. They don't really know my comedy. They don't know what I'm like as a comedian or as a person. So they come out and I've had people write me and say, I really didn't enjoy your show. And I said, right, but if you expect me to change it, it would be horrible, wouldn't it? Because this is actually who I am. So you're just going to have to go find comedy elsewhere because this is what I do.
Yeah.
And I know you're expecting something different, but I'm not.
After that happened, you truly call that night that happened on stage a nervous breakdown?
That was the beginning of an actual nervous breakdown because what was happening was I was starting to wrestle with the duality of what was going on with my career and an inability. I realized I was losing all my coping skills.
Wow.
I didn't like what I was just telling you about being able to check in on the internet and figure out what was going on with my career. Yeah. I didn't understand what I'm telling you.
Wow.
All that stuff was happening, but it was just noise. I didn't know.
And to you, it feels like the universe is just going, look at this person be successful. Look at this person be successful.
Right. I didn't know I didn't understand what was happening. I don't think we all kind of understood what was happening. A lot of guys were freaking out, including Mark Maron.
I have a friend who's like always like, you know, a comedian, you know, not on your level, but like going, oh, you know, look, this person's doing this and this person I'm doing. I'm like, everybody puts out everything they do as if it's the greatest thing in the world, and everybody promotes all the best stuff they do. Of course, nobody puts on Facebook, I fucking bombed last night, or here's a gig I lost. You never hear about that.
Right.
It sounds like it's an endless series of wins, wins, wins.
Right.
Nobody's life or career is going like that, but that's what you think if you just think Facebook is telling you the
truth. Right, and all you're seeing is content, and everyone's putting out content, and just because it's on a blog or a thing or even a – and there's so much content now that it's like it's only a matter of like you have no idea who saw what or what happened or whatever.
Yeah.
It just – it doesn't – it also – you don't have to be looking at it. You need to be creating – and then putting it out and hoping nobody else sees it.
Yeah, and like be done with it. Yeah.
Yeah,
you don't need the feedback.
You don't need the feedback.
And somebody like yourself, Greg, who's obviously very driven in so many ways, I would think that some kind of medication, like Hannes and I were talking earlier, can help in terms of letting you focus a little bit and settle down and not get too – I mean, I can see the anxiety in somebody as driven as yourself.
Well, that was a – I mean, that's been a revelation for me. I mean, that was like my – that was – you know, you were talking about the – I think what you were thinking of as Effexor. Did you say started with an A?
Yes, a very early antidepressant.
Yeah, so I take Wellbutrin and Zoloft.
Yeah.
And a thing called Topamax.
You have any of that? I can buy some of that off.
Yeah.
Topamax is like an anti-seizure thing,
it's an anti-seizure drug that they use to combat the massive weight gain that you get from SSRIs, which are Zoloft.
But I had an ex-husband who took Topamax for migraine headaches.
Yes.
So they're different. You never know. There's a cocktail for everybody.
You know, it's so funny about drugs. They always like it almost that like whatever they're inventing it for, it turns out it's good for something else.
Yes.
Like Viagra was supposed to be a heart pill and it turned out every guy in this trial got a massive heart on. They went, well, maybe it's good for that.
Yes. And Propecia is very good for your
hair.
Yes.
But it was for something else.
Yeah,
right?
It's just good for your heart as well. And good for your Dopamax. They call it Topamax Dopamax because it's very bad for your memory.
Oh, really?
Your short term.
Yeah. Like marijuana.
Yes.
Yeah. What?
What? Huh? Who?
Where? Exactly.
Captain? Major?
And so, but now you have done other work with Oprah Winfrey. You taught a life class with her.
Yeah, because we kept writing books. So then we
did. Yeah, there was like, what the fuck? Or no, it's just a fucking dick.
Yeah, so that was kind of a nice little, so that was the one book that got dropped, and then we released it on our own, and then Oprah let us, and then Oprah asked us to teach life classes. So.
Wait, it's just a fucking date. Was that with Liz or with your wife?
So Liz and I only wrote the first book, and then Liz didn't want to write books anymore.
Interesting.
Didn't want to write self-help books anymore. Which is she's had a great career since she wrote her own book and then she just directed a film and she's
good for
written
her. Yeah.
Series. She's so great. She's so talented. And then so Amira and I have written books.
When you go from comedian to, you know, a relationship expert, but there's no, you know, there's no letters after that. There's no, you know, I was a psychology major or I have a master's in, you know, physiology or something like that. And so people are coming to you. Do they think that you're a therapist or that you're a doctor or that you're a what are they thinking? Because you're an entertainer first.
I think we made it pretty clear on the first one that that's who we were, that it's coming from a friend. Like it's pretty clear, and we reinstated it constantly in the book. Like this is
it's such an honest concept. Yeah, I think that's why people latched onto it.
Yeah,
it's very honest.
And we constantly recommend that people seek actual help.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, we're just saying from our experience and get help from our experience.
Like
and
Paul
get
Gilmartin,
help.
He always says, you know, I am not a therapist.
Yeah, the books are fun to write and they're silly and they're meant to be more.
I think some of the people reading the book took them as entertaining, silly, but silly in the way that life is silly and I understand what's going on. Some took them as dead serious.
Yeah, they're common sense. It's common sense. But people will always, as they have with all of the books written about everything, you know, people latch on and decide to make their own meaning and to take their own meaning out of everything, to compare the books to the Bible. But people like to interpret words in many different ways. And unfortunately, one of the problems I think with life is that people are so looking for philosophy as opposed to trying to create their own that they that it becomes very difficult for you who's written the words and for people who attach themselves to the words to enjoy it because then you're like, look, I'm – you know, this is – take it and wrap it up, read it, and throw it away. Pass it on. You know what I mean? Take what you need and leave the rest. This is – I'm a guy that wrote this.
How do you decide where to put your energy? Do you work on many projects at a time or do you wake up and think like, I think I'll start writing or I think I'll work on my music?
I just generally do pieces at a time. I can't stick to one thing all the time. So I will literally work on something for 15, 20 minutes and go to the next thing, then go pick my daughters up from school, then come back. Like it's a
I'm like that too, and I can work until midnight because you don't need to worry about
the time. I like to just bounce from thing to thing, you know. I mean, I am pretty good at like
deadlines.
I'm working on this one man show that I'm taking to Australia. So I have a performance of it on Monday. So that's the thing I'm working on now until Monday. Then that'll be done. Then I have a corporate that I have to work all clean.
Tell us about the one man show. What's it called?
It's called I Am the King Sweater, and it's about 2 years that I spent in Japan playing rockabilly from 1985 to 1987.
No kidding. How old were you? 1985, so you're like 20 years old.
I was 23.
Yeah. And I had no idea. I mean, I know you have a band now, The Reigning Monarchs, and I know it's an instrumental band.
Yeah.
And it kind of has a ska, rockabilly.
Ska, rockabilly, surf thing.
Surf thing going on where it's just great in the background the time.
Yeah.
Your music is so entertaining.
Thank you.
Is. And your partner's Ange, who's your partner on that?
Well, Mike Eisenstein, who was in Letters to Cleo.
Okay, right. And thinking of you have a t-shirt company as well.
I had a t-shirt company. I gave it to Angelo.
You gave it to Angelo Warner. That was the, interesting. Because we were thinking of getting some t-shirts. So that's why I think of that.
Yeah, he's good.
What about Walking the Room with Dave Anthony? That
I
was
love
so
Dave Anthony.
Popular.
It was super popular. And
a lot of fans.
A lot of fans. It was very dark and very personal. And we did it for 4 years, 4.5 years. And then I went to Australia and I came back and then I went to New York for 22 weeks to work on a show. And we had a little lover spat and we broke it up. And now we're doing a live one in Australia.
Oh, wow.
And we sold out the first venue, and then we got put into another venue, and we sold that out.
Is that in Sydney? Or Melbourne.
Melbourne.
Wow, Australians so, love the Americans, as I understand.
They've been very, very kind to us.
That is so awesome. How long will we be in Australia this next time?
9 weeks.
Oh, come on.
I'll do a month in Sydney, a month in Melbourne, a week in Sydney, and then I'll go on the road with Kirkman.
Oh, how fun is that? Yeah, She's been on the story where they
By the way, it actually
well.
Takes 8 weeks to fly to Australia.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not that long.
Flying.
It's actually, I'm just there for seven. I'm there for like 7 or 8 hours, and then
listen,
I fly
that
back.
Is yeah. such a wonderful country. Well, you're gonna have a ball, man.
I've been quite a bit. I've been like 6 years.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah. Now, wait, when you're doing the show on Monday, which is a rehearsal for the show, or it's a performance?
Yeah, it's a rehearsal. It's at the UCB Theater.
Oh, great.
It's at the
so it's open to the public then.
It's open to the public. Yeah. I've done it 5 times, so it's.
Are you kind of workshopping it then?
I'm workshopping
it. Who's your director?
I am a director.
Wow. I think that's very hard to see yourself. I mean, in terms of, I've done a one-woman show and I've done some different things on stage, but I feel like sometimes Hannes, I'll say, just listen to this, and then he can cut the fat so quickly because he sees it not from my point of view. How do you direct yourself?
I think at this point, I'm growing it, and then I'll let people come in. At this point, I want to just take a lot of chances with it. It has music in it, and it's got some visuals, and there's like these things where I'm like, let's let me grow it, let me just figure it all out and put it out there until it gets super fat, and then have somebody come in and go.
You don't need.
But I don't need directing now because it's not ready for it.
Interesting. That's why.
Yeah, my manager thinks of course every manager thinks it should be somewhere like off Broadway or something. So who knows?
You were talking about when things went kind of south for you and you lost your agent, manager, lawyer, everybody goes away. But this, like you said, it's not personal. It's like if you can't pay these people, they think I can't work for you because I'm not getting paid. Do you think that's the bottom line, or do you think it's
a
disloyalty?
I think people. One manager quit the business, so that's not her fault.
Right. I had an agent go to be a real estate agent, and then then they're gone.
Yeah, she quit the business, and then I ended up with my original manager because he owned the management company she worked for, and then she quit, and then I got him back.
Yeah.
So he's been my main guy forever. So I love him, and he's been around forever. So
that's
he's
awesome.
Good. But then my agent became the president of HBO. So then then I lost the whole. Just all this stuff happened. So. Some of it was personal, some of it wasn't. Some of it, I definitely lost some people just because they were like, nah, I'm just done. You know, there's just people that are fair weather and then there's people that aren't, you know? And,
So the whole business, it's a process and it kind of ebbs and flows and people come in and out of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to get the message from you because you've had such success and then you've also had things fail. I mean, you get a show and then the show's gone.
I think there is the truth of it is if you can't make any money for anybody and people are in the business of making money, they can't do anything with you. They're going to go unless you're best friends.
When I hear people complain about their agent, I think like – how much money did you make them last year?
Yeah,
like,
what do you do?
Expecting?
You have to start thinking what is the value that
business.
I bring them.
It's not called show fun, Hannes.
It's not called show friends.
No,
it's not show friends.
It's show business.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really
it's
does mean.
Jews. And no,
I think
that's not the name.
It is also, there is something about people who stick with you, but then there is also, and you also have to look at what it is that you really want. What are you really doing?
Mm-hmm.
What's
the point?
Yeah, what are you going to make?
What are you going to do if you have an agent and, one of the huge agencies comes to you and says, CAA or something, and says, we want to sign you. Are you not going to leave your agent on Metro Boulevard? You're not going to take the biggest agency in the world,
Beverly
Hills?
Well, especially you have to think, who are you protecting? At the end of the day, I have a responsibility to my wife and children. They're the only thing – they're the only people I care about. So I'm not also in it for friends.
Yeah. How is that going to be, going to Australia without your children for 2.5 months?
Or are they
going
to come?
Well, I went to New York for 22 weeks without them.
But that's this country and that's 5 hours
away. Yeah, well, I didn't see them.
Oh, wow. You never came back? They never came to New York?
No, we couldn't.
Wow.
They went to school. I worked every single day. I think it's hard. It's not as hard as you think because even now, they get up and go to school and they're gone all
day.
And
I
work
right.
and then they are at dance until 8:30 at night. And I mean, it's hard and
harder on your wife.
It's harder on – it's not harder having somebody not pitching in all the time.
That's so true. In a family, I have a daughter. It's just me and my daughter. And I find that the hardest part of it, it's not like so much the loneliness or like the – it's the Nobody's going to take that fucking trash out unless I take it out. It's not going anywhere. Yeah. Nobody's going to clean the litter box. There's no help. So that
it's like a team. You're like a team.
Your team is gone. Your team is broken apart. Yeah.
But I think they also, they get the, it's what we do. We're gypsies. So it's, so they get what we do.
Do you Skype with your kids and stuff and all that?
Well,
or
they can. They text. Yeah.
You could text all the time.
They like the phone
stuff.
You
still know what's going on in everybody's life.
Yeah, we're pretty connected. Yeah. I mean, I go and sit and, I go to the dance studio and just sit and watch.
What kind of dance do they do?
All of it. They do modern, they do contemporary, they do jazz, they do lyrical, they do all of it. And then they compete, and they compete in different, they compete solo, they compete in groups.
Do you ever have to go to a competition and you'd rather be home watching the Super Bowl?
Nope. I don't care about sports.
Wow, interesting.
I'd rather go home. I mean, I follow it and I will watch it, but I'd rather. I know. I like going to the competitions.
Yeah, interesting. And do you?
The thing is, that's what they do. Mm-hmm. So I follow it.
That's who they are.
That's They're not going to play soccer. They're right. Not, that's so. I either have the. I can't be like, man, their dance thing. That's shitty parenting.
That is shitty
so
parenting.
So I watch the dance movies with them. I watch the step ups. I learn.
Oh,
I know what all.
You
the,
are a dedicated father. You're watching that.
I don't
shit.
Have a choice. Is what they do. It's like if
no,
they.
I know,
it's like
but,
if they,
yeah, but
if they
I
play
watch
rugby.
The class that they're in. I'm not watching the fucking movie. Step up 3D. I'm not watching that.
Well, see, here's what I did.
But if you watch that, then you know who Twitch is, and you know who the people
you're
are.
You're in their
also,
life.
But you also see what it is.
You're being
that's
supportive.
That's what the sport is.
Sure.
And you see it at the top of its game, and you go, those are what the moves are. That's what dance is. Like that right now, that's the sport. It's like watching the sport at the top of its game when you watch the and how it's choreographed and stuff and how it's made. So then I go, okay, that's what they're trying for. That's what they're trying to
You're
achieve.
Such a
I mean,
good
they
dad.
Don't do the hip hop stuff as much, but if you know, I played sports all the way through college, so it's not like I didn't do that thing. So I get kind of what I'm trying to
this
learn.
This is interesting. You should say this because I do know that you come from a sort of a sports background, and when I've heard you talk on other podcasts about sports, I find it interesting because I felt like. From what I got from you is that you were kind of forced into sports or you thought that's what you should do. You thought
I should be
a football guy. This is how you got to be cool. This is how I got to be in a frat or I got to do this. And I felt like that in junior high school and high school, like I had to be a cheerleader and I had to do the thing and then I had to do the thing. And then I quit it all and, you know, totally went like the theater direction, as it were.
Yeah.
But it's interesting when you have a parent who doesn't understand that. And so, were you encouraged into sports or didn't they ever say like, hey, Greg, maybe you'd be better?
My mom
theater.
Was like, get in the theater. I don't know why you play
she
sports.
She told you that?
Yeah, she was like, you're a
and
terrible
you didn't
athlete.
Do it.
And yeah, my
God
and
damn.
my father would have done anything. And they loved when I became a comedian. They loved it. They loved when I became a theater
so
major.
They told you that from the get-go.
Yeah, but I was like, you don't fucking know anything. I'm a very good athlete. And they were like, you're not. You really aren't.
Oh, that's
you're
so
not
funny.
Tough and you've got weird eyes and you're not gifted and you're certainly not graceful. But I just felt like my buddies did it and I wanted to do what my buddies did and I wanted to be tough. And I'm not a pussy. And I was a pretty good rugby player, but I just didn't know how I would get girls. I just didn't know how I would I didn't know how I'd have friends.
Yeah.
Like no truly.
No, but I think that's
when I grew up, like I didn't understand I didn't know how to relate to other men unless I played
right.
And I didn't understand that I would have the kinds of friends I thought I was supposed to have and the kind of friends that guys had in movies. I didn't know how I would be a man if I didn't do those things until I went to college and had a gay friend. It was like, I didn't even know these kind of guys existed.
Yeah.
And then bands. And then I was like, holy fuck, where was this hiding?
Yeah.
You know? And
well,
then
that's
I saw
what makes the internet
then,
so nice.
And
it's
then,
all small.
Oh, now everybody
now
can
understand.
Be everything.
Now
you
can do
oh,
it.
Shit. I mean, it's just like, you know, I said the other night on stage, I was like, you know, I mean, poor Bruce Jenner this weekend, but Jesus Christ, if that guy makes it from the Wheaties box to the to fucking Lane Bryant, God damn it, what a journey.
Amazing.
How great that can happen.
Wonderful.
And how great that people can see that and how important for so many people that there's just like, it's all bets are off now. People
can
pretty
I love it.
Much, I mean, in a lot of places, no, and certainly in Middle Eastern countries, but we're at least at a point
thing.
Now that like, there doesn't have to be so much fucking fear and people can kind of just do what they want. And most people will leave you alone. And you know, we're starting to get there.
I think people's personalities remain the same and consistent, you know, in their terms of their social media and who they put out. That's basically who they are.
Right, right.
You know? Yeah. But it's funny about the because it's funny you think like, well, he can be transgender. Well, yeah, probably not in Oklahoma or something. But then even to be like a transgender man in a small town in Oklahoma is better than to be even a slightly effeminate man somewhere in Saudi Arabia or something. You know, it's
right.
like the rest of the world, right. we have no idea how backwards.
Right.
You think the most backward place in the United States – it's 1,000 light years ahead of
right.
gigantic portions of this.
But at least the guy in Oklahoma knows there's a place he can go.
Yeah.
At least the guy in Oklahoma knows, oh shit, at least I can fly to the coast. At least I can get out somehow. There's a safe haven for me somewhere.
You grew up in the suburbs very much like I did and like Hannes did, where it's like the father goes to work. Your father was in the ad business, right? Because I heard
TV.
You in television. So I heard you talk about kind of the Mad Men days and how it sort of looked like that when you were growing up.
Yeah. I grew up in the Mad Men. Mad Men was like a documentary. Like I grew up in a lot of people smoking,
a lot of drinking, a lot of alcohol,
very glamorous, very like.
But we were only told what was told out of the mouths of our parents. Like there was no other source.
No, And I thought all people drank and smoked and like you just didn't have anything. So it looked good on the outside, but dark on the inside.
Yeah.
And yeah. So.
You've had such an amazing journey. Are you writing a book? No, you did the one person show. I know your energy's there. But what about another book?
I probably will write something. I don't know. I probably will do something about mental health at some point.
Yeah, because I mean, just the journey you just told us is fascinating.
Yeah,
it's very much a Hollywood story.
Yeah, if I can figure out a way to articulate it and make it really funny, you know, if I started to, I was writing something a couple of years ago. Patton had actually hooked me up with his agent. And I was starting to write something, but then I stopped. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, maybe with some of the travel time coming up, you'll have a second.
Yeah.
One more thing I want to talk about. You said, was it you or Dave Anthony's grandmother with a hoarding problem?
My grandmother's housekeeper who lived with her had a hoarding problem in the garage and kept her own shit.
And
kept dead cats in her box, in her freezer.
Yeah, this is one of the episodes I listened to of Walking in the Room, Hoarders and Alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about your grandmother's housekeeper would go to the bathroom in coffee cans.
Yes, that's right.
And then keep it.
Yeah, she kept she shit in coffee cans.
And how was Walking the Room not at the top of the charts? How are
I don't
we not
know.
Backed at this podcast?
I don't
podcast?
Know.
I mean,
I don't
with
know.
Gold like that.
I have to tell you that among the things that I've done in comedy, being doing comedy with Dave Anthony is among my favorite things.
I can imagine.
He is so fun to do stuff with. So fun.
But now with traveling and stuff, obviously you can't make the time. I find like podcasts that start Skyping and phoning in and stuff, it doesn't translate as well because you can't see the other person talk.
Yeah, it just is. Yeah, yeah.
The
it's really hard.
Isn't...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to be really close with Dave so that I can hate him. My grandmother had a housekeeper who was a terrible housekeeper and a fairly nice person, but she was busy shitting in cans and keeping dead cats.
I hate to tell you this, that was your grandmother's lover.
What's that?
That was your grandmother's lover. She was never the housekeeper. That's why this was all the story.
You never know. But she died, and then my dad went into her room and just went, oh, good Lord. I mean, he walked out like he'd been in Vietnam, like there was heads, and he was just like, don't go in there, and everybody went in there, and then the police had to come, and there was just, there were just frozen cats.
Frozen cats.
And I think some rats and rat shit.
In a freezer.
And hands full of human shit, her own shit.
In a freezer? Wait.
In a freezer. There was a freezer that my grandma had to keep frozen food, but that she just kept cats in.
That is an unbelievable story.
Nobody ever went in that room.
No, because it was her bedroom and she kept it locked.
Yeah.
And my grandma my grandma lived to be 99, so she wasn't up going in there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a wild story.
It's insane. Like I didn't, and that was before hoarding was like a thing. Like we just thought she was a mad person. I mean, hoarding hadn't become like this sort of thing that we all kind of understand.
Yeah. Oh, I don't even know if I understand
but
it.
But we know it's a
thing. Yeah, it's a thing.
We know it's an aberration.
Hoarders like to do is they like to put things in plastic bags or bins, and then they think they've taken care of the problem.
Right.
If they organize it in such a way.
Right.
So they keep hoarding, but in a neater fashion.
But if you look at hoarding and clutter, and then you just look at that as like small, like a difference between little bit of mental illness and a lot of mental illness.
Interesting.
And how mental illness is something that a lot of people suffer from in varying degrees. It's such a fucking heavy title, mental illness, but it is something that a lot of people suffer from, or in varying degrees, or something that has a progressive feel to it. Because I never thought of it that way, but once I got on medication, I'm like, this has been around since forever in my head.
Isn't it true medication doesn't change your personality? It just, like, cuts out the noise.
Well, that's the thing. People are always like, I don't want to, like, lose my edge or lose whatever. And when I say to people, it's like, it
first of all, you didn't have an edge.
It didn't. First off, I never had an edge.
Yeah.
Secondly, and I was never
funny. I don't want to stop being funny.
I wasn't funny.
You were never funny.
I wasn't funny before. The second thing is, and I always tell somebody, I wasn't looking to be happy. I was looking to not be sad.
Yeah.
Waking up and not being sad
is enough.
Is enough.
Yeah.
Waking up and not being terrified or angry or paranoid, like, that's a whole other world where you're like, I'm just fine, actually. Like, I can just get stuff done. And that is enough. I don't need to be.
And then you can go and you can have a bad day.
Yes, and also I get kind of.
Which just is, I've had a bad day as opposed to, well, my life is over.
Yes, and I get scared when I get elated because elation is not that great of a feeling.
Oh, that's very uncomfortable for me.
Well, also, like, I don't want to be up there. I like knowing that, like, later on I'm going to go right, and I feel pretty good about that, and I have this thing that I'm working on that I'm proud of. Like,
yeah,
I feel
you know what's coming.
I feel pride, and I feel excited about the fact that I can work. I feel certain different feelings about work. I feel like I can get more done.
You're more level-headed.
Yes, but I also don't, like, I don't take defeat that, like I went to the improv the other night, and I had an abysmal set, crowd-wise. I had a fine time on stage, and my writing partner was there, was like, that was bizarre because I thought you were having – you seemed elated.
You got done what you needed to get done,
maybe. The crowd seemed to not really enjoy it at all.
Did you get done, like, you accomplished what you wanted to do?
I think so. And I also – yeah, exactly. Or I'll go and I'll do a set and, like – and I'm like, I only was looking for this part of it to get done.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, you know, and then I'll go out and do sets that are all good and sometimes whatever. But the stakes are so low now in terms of, like – I was only looking for this part or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, the stakes are low, or I don't feel the need
to. Like, you're a true success story in Hollywood. You really are.
Because
you're coming out the other end of these ups and downs, but you're coming out, like very aware, fully aware.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope so. And I hope that I can maintain it. But I also am able to look around and see, like, I think one of the things I'm looking at or hoping to be able to share with people is like with other people is, like, don't get lost on the wrong stuff here, because this is all just content, and it doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, if you
it's
miss
just
the,
one little
well,
piece
if you miss
in
the real stuff, which is just having fun with each other. You know, when I was directing stuff this summer, when I got to direct, and I heard Chris Rock say this the other day, and I thought it was the best thing I've heard in a million years. They said, "What do you enjoy? Did you enjoy directing? Do you like that more than doing stand-up?" He goes, "I just found that I prefer being George Clinton now more than being Prince, because in Parliament, George Clinton just sits at the side and hits a bell or bangs on a pot.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that much more. Being with a group of people, like, I don't give a fuck about being in front of the camera.
Yeah.
I don't care about it being about me. But I got to be in a field of people, and I had the camera, and then there was a fucking sound guy, and I knew the whole crew.
Oh, the energy,
and I loved the actors. And there was just a bunch of us, and it was 4 a.m, and it's cold, and the thing we're working on is hard. And it's just fun, and it's just people. And we had a good day, and I don't give a shit about, like, how popular I am, or if anyone likes me, like, in a, like, if I'm on the Huffington, like, it doesn't, the accolades don't mean anything, and they go away so quickly, and the negatives don't mean anything because nobody gives a shit. You know what I mean?
It's like
we were all screaming about American Sniper last week, and now that's just in the echo chamber, and it's all gone.
But is it being together in the moment, or is it the fact that you're creating something, or is it both? Because I find it amazing that you can get 20, 30, 40 people together and they create something.
Well,
it's amazing.
I still have a buzz from doing that stuff this summer working with that crew. I don't have a big buzz off of doing a set in Tacoma 2 weekends ago.
I see.
That didn't stick with me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Having an amazing set on Valentine's Day doesn't leave a buzz with me being by myself in Tacoma. But like shooting a scene with two girls in this apartment with a bunch of us and getting a laugh out of something we didn't think finding a
blast. It's like being a kid.
Yeah, and being with a bunch of people and watching somebody else be funny and being able to find
it's
that together. Like that feels like worthy. It felt like a team effort.
And
like,
you're with your peers. These are your people.
Yeah.
These are your people. They
doing
get
stuff
it.
With Dave. Like that, doing that stuff with Dave felt like something because it feels like that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. I like being with you, Hannes.
Discover
I'll be honest
it.
With you.
Does it feel worthy?
Hey, listen,
speaking of feeling worthy.
Do you want to play some Shotgun Story with
you? I do.
Music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Fish. Oh, this is, shit. Every time I see fish, all I can think about is that fucking Led Zeppelin story. Where the story of Led Zeppelin where they get the girl drunk and then they put a fish in her. They were bad people, Led Zeppelin. They were not good. You know what I mean? They're a great band, but they stole songs and they stuck fish in people. You know, that's unfair when but they were so good despite that. Yeah. When you can overcome good tone, with good tone, that's what's so shitty. That's what's so shitty.
Yeah, I love it.
Wait a minute. I've never heard this story.
Oh, it's
classic. Believe it.
Hammer of the Gods. Hammer of the Gods.
And they did what exactly?
I think Jimmy Page was really the guy that was not the good.
They got a girl drunk and inserted a fish into her.
Yeah, that's it. I think
yeah,
right?
That's tough.
Been one of the roadies, but somebody stuck a fish inside of one. Do you read Hammer of the Gods? You're too young.
No,
yeah,
Andrew knows it. Andrew, all good sound guys know Zeppelin.
Isn't that right?
Everybody's brother knows Zeppelin, and everybody's sound guy knows Zeppelin.
They were like in Seattle. They were somewhere in the Northwest.
Seattle. There's fish everywhere. She probably slipped and fell on it.
They were probably at the Pike Place Market, and somebody just threw a fish.
Yeah, threw it across, and she jumped
and
up.
And she was wearing a skirt without underwear.
It was a quality fish.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't
It wasn't like a... It was a king salmon. Like,
yeah. I mean, it was a decent piece of fish. It was a good cut. I mean, it was
but
a decent fish.
It's funny how it's like you're
good
like...
color.
It overcomes because like people are like, I don't want to watch Woody Allen movies because I think this about him or I think that about him. It's like you were born at the wrong time.
Right.
Like, you mentioned Bill Burry. He had a joke about it. It's like, you know, Walt Disney died at the right time. He was an ill anti-Semite, but nobody gives a shit because he's been dead since 1970. It's like... You go to Disneyland, if he were still alive and people were like, you know, he fucking hates Jews, that'd put a real crimp in the Disneyland business.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. He did not need social media. Yeah.
No, there's got to be people whose art, we don't know what Michelangelo was like. What if he was the worst fucking human being in the world?
I heard he was a dick.
Yeah, Angela. He was like a killer and a rapist and a child strangler.
He owes
we
me
don't
$10.
Know this. We're like, look at the beautiful paintings he made.
That's so true.
We just don't fucking know. And so
know.
Someday people are going to be like, oh, somebody's going to watch a fucking Cosby show and go, this is amazing. And they're going to be like, well, you know, it's like, really? When that happened? 60 years ago. Everyone's dead.
In 50 years, we'll all be dead.
Oh,
that's what I'm saying. That's
the thing.
That's
hey, listen, good luck in Australia, man.
Thank you. This was fun,
I know
guys.
That continent will love you. I do love you. You've been going there. I've been there
for a while. Yeah, they've always been very kind to me.
Yeah, really great audiences down there,
They're
I understand.
Nice, right?
And that's awesome, man. Awesome. And good luck with your children and their dance.
Thank you.
I'm happy for them that they've found a path that they really like.
Yeah, thank you.
I purposely...
Because, by the way, that's where the money is.
Dance.
Yeah, that's a really
I put my
career.
Kid in a tennis camp because I enjoy the game
tennis
of tennis.
Is amazing.
And so
my wife's
kinda,
obsessed.
Is she really?
Is she obsessed with Christine's boyfriend, Rafael Nadal?
He's my boyfriend, Rafael
Okay,
Nadal.
The girl, we met Nadal.
Oh, my God. Seriously?
We met Nadal, and he took his wristbands off, and he gave them to my daughters.
Oh.
And they were both like, these are wet.
This is dirty.
Yeah.
These are wet. That's what they said.
Yeah.
And then what?
And then we have them.
Oh, my gosh. Greg Barron, that's gold.
Isn't that crazy?
That's gold.
The wristbands are wet. Guess what's wet right now?
Yeah, I know.
I love Rafael Nadal.
He was like a prince.
Where does your wife play? Toluca Lake?
She doesn't play. She just watches.
Oh, I see.
She doesn't play anymore. She's a Djokovic fan.
Oh, okay, huh?
But we were...
He's got some power at the net because he's so tall.
He's incredible. He's great. Djokovic is great. I like Nadal. Although I think his days may be numbered.
Those are big words, my friend.
I know, but it's always
those are big words. You know what? They've been saying that though for like 4 years about him.
I know, but where
he's fucking coming back.
I know, but where was he? Where was he at the Australian?
All Christine needs is to be there on the day that he drops in the rankings. That's the day you need to be there.
I know, he's still number three. He's still number three.
I feel a little uncertain about myself.
He's a Spaniard. He's not an Englishman.
I don't know if it was Mallorcan.
Who learned English from an
Mallorcan,
English teacher.
He's Mallorcan.
Right.
Mallorcan. He was very, very sweet. He's very good looking in person. He looks like a prince.
So handsome.
We were lucky. We were with some friends that knew him, and so we got to go.
Were
back.
You at the U.S. Open?
Yep.
Oh, man. That
we
was
the
great,
US Open.
Huh? How many times have you gotten to see that?
I've been in the U.S. Open twice, or was it once?
I need to do that. I really want to go to that.
Yeah, you got
to
go. And then we went. Was that? Or did we see him at Indian Wells? Maybe we met him at Indian Wells.
He's out there at least every year, and he's at the.
We
Staples
met him
Center.
In Indian Wells.
We
met him in Indian Wells.
I've even seen him over at the Home Depot Center, the Galaxy Place.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean he's played all over the Southern California.
Yeah,
of course,
yeah, yeah.
And, of course, in your dreams.
In my dreams, yeah. He's every night in my dreams. No
well, in that poster, it's on your wall.
What are we going to do about his hair? It's thinning.
Oh, no. Listen, I wasn't looking at his hair, number one.
Yeah.
But that's another thing.
It doesn't matter.
Did you ever read the book Open by Andre Agassi?
No.
Oh, man. There's a book called Open, right? It is so fascinating. Andre Agassi talking about his life, the way he grew up, his father, the way his father just drilled him into tennis. I mean, it's kind of a horror story. However, then, you know, he goes through his marriage with Brooke Shields and then finally meeting Steffi Graf. And it is just so thorough. He comes on, he grows his hair, he's wearing that hairpiece.
Oh, yeah.
He was like the rock and roll, but you couldn't deny his talent. And it's just how he was so audacious for so long, but then came around. He had this whole transformation.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Called Open. You'll whip right through it.
I was at a party when I first moved here. I was at, you know, Kathy Griffin was an old buddy.
Yeah.
And so she was on Suddenly Susan.
And Brooke Shields,
so
right.
We were at a party Kathy's house one night, and he was there.
Yeah, was it her Christmas party?
Probably.
Yeah, she always had a really, maybe she still has a really big Christmas
party. No, this was before. She was living in a little place on, this was when she was living in a little place up on Beechwood Canyon, a little tiny place, and they were just standing out in the, he was there.
Wow.
But that didn't last that long.
No, only like 2 years. It's a really great chapter in the book. So, anyway, throw that out there. Speaking of books, hey, why not pick up my new book, Pit to LAX, My Story-Worthy Life.
Does it involve your marriage to Andre Agassi?
No, but it does include my obsession with Rafael Nadal.
I love it.
No, it doesn't. All right, you guys, we got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Andrew Stephen. There's just the two names, Andrew and Stephen. There's no S's, just Andrew and Stephen.
By the way, when Greg came in, I introduced Andrew as Anthony, just because I'm a fucking idiot.
And on behalf of everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Sean Merrick and Roddy Swearingen, and of course our storyteller tonight, Greg Barron, thank you so much.
Oh, it was awesome. Thank you,
really
guys.
Really a wonderful story. You are really an inspiration.
Oh, yes.
Excellent stuff. And on behalf of John Thomas Griffith, you know, he's the guy that wrote the theme song, Storyworthy.
I don't know anything about this guy. I'm sick of hearing about it. I don't know who he is. I don't even think he exists.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host.
I also do not exist.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week. Can
thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.